When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This edition of The Literary Life is the very first one in a year and a half that I've recorded live and in person. And sitting across from Lauren Groff at Books and Books this afternoon makes it all that much more sweet. Her new novel, Matrix, is a sensation. A finalist for the National Book Award, Lauren brings to life the world of a 12th century abbey and the nuns who live there. Praise for Matrix has been coming in fast and furious. One of my favorites is this line from USA Today. Matrix is a relentless exhibition of Groff's freakish talent. In just over 250 pages, she gives us a character study to rival Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell. So how are you, Lauren?
I'm doing very well. How are you? I'm very relaxed. It's wonderful.
Well, this is a very cool thing today, because this is the first time since the pandemic started. So it's the first time in about almost a year and a half that we are doing this podcast in person at our Carl Gable store. And I can't think of a better person to do it with than you.
Oh, you're the kindest. I'm so delighted. I keep doing the first of a lot of things right now, and people just keep crying. And it's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. I'm on the verge right now.
Well, we're in that time where it's really great to be among people. And you forget what it's like, you know, to be among people in the way that we haven't been.
We're all slightly unskinned at the moment, which is good and bad, I think, probably in both ways.
Yeah. So you're on book tour now, right?
It's a semi-book tour. Right. A lot of it has been Zoom. Yeah.
Zoom, but then in person.
And some in person.
Which is really great.
Oh, it's amazing.
And for those of you who don't know, Lauren lives in Gainesville, Florida.
I do.
So that's about, people don't understand Florida, do they?
Nobody understands. Do you understand?
No, well, I even beyond understanding, I grew up here, but they don't even know the geography of Florida.
No, it's
so. When
true.
We say Gainesville, they say, "Oh, Mitchell and Lauren probably see each other. It's probably a half an hour away from each other."
No,
but it's like five, six hours away.
I think it's 6 hours. The way I drive, it's 6 hours for sure. Yeah,
right. It's where the University of Florida is,
and
all of that. So coming down here is truly like coming to the tropics, right?
No, it definitely, because we're in the subtropics, and we don't have iguanas, right? We don't have orchids in the trees. It's very astonishing. I almost feel like I'm coming to Beverly Hills when I come to Coral Gables.
Right? Well, where did they put you up?
The Biltmore. It's amazing. It's so cool. You can feel the ghosts of the 1920s and 30s in it, for sure.
Yeah, Johnny Weissmuller and all those guys.
Yeah.
And that's where they have the biggest iguanas right around
there.
Oh,
so actually. Huge. One stole my lunch today. Oh, really? I know, at the pool. It was amazing. I loved it. I was feeding it too.
Yeah, well, you know, in Carl Gables, it's all Mediterranean style architecture. Tonight, we're going to be at a church that's across the street from the Biltmore, that beautiful church right across the street.
Great.
Where the
reading's
going to be. Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Oh, wonderful.
And so everything in Carl Gables was built in the 20s, even though for most of the world, that's not very old, but that's really old in Miami.
It's really old in Florida. Right?
Yeah.
No, it's wonderful.
It very much is. I have to tell you, I read Matrix, and it's remarkable. It's really,
it's really weird.
It's very weird. But, you know, for someone who really knows not much about it, for me, it was like entering a world that I just had no idea even existed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll talk more specifically, but... You know, I wish, you know, I'm a product of the 60s in high school and college, early 70s. And because of that, I know nothing about history or anything. So Eleanor of Aquitaine is not someone that I really, really knew, or Marie de France, or, you know, what was happening in the abbeys, or 12th century Europe is not something I know the history of very well. So how come you do?
When I was in college, I wanted to be a medievalist. So I took a lot of Ancien Français, which is Old French. And I just love it. I love the literature of the time. I love the humor. In researching this book, I came across a lot of manuscripts that, you know, my faulty Latin was somewhat helpful in trying to figure out. But you often find this marginalia, these drawings that these bored nuns or and monks generally did. And some of them are hilarious. They're called drolleries. There's some like nuns plucking penises off the penis tree. There's some like a merman being shot in the butt by an archer. It's just wild.
So these are like the doodles.
These are doodles on these.
Are they on books? Are they on parchment?
Ecclesiastical manuscripts, right? Because there was no printing press at the time, so everything had to be hand done.
But would you point out, which is something that I didn't quite realize, is that, you know, most of the scribes clearly were not women.
No. I mean, most women at the time were not given any kind of education whatsoever. Right. And really only noble women were given literacy and numeracy because they were expected to take over the estates that they were supposed to run while the husbands were off fighting wars or doing the Crusades and conquering Jerusalem and everything. So, so the idea of having even a whole abbey full of literate women is, you know, just an abbey full of treasure, basically. Wow. Yeah.
So as a medievalist in college and...
A wannabe.
Right. And I think you studied French and well as English Lit.
Yes.
So this is something that had to have been planted very early,
I would imagine.
Yeah, so what is the origin of this? When did you start thinking of Marie de France, who actually is a real person, right?
She is a real person,
She wrote, she was a poet.
She wrote two books that we know of, and one she may have written. But the two books were Lay and Fables. And the Lay are these incredible, fantastical short stories, basically in poetic form, drawing on previous traditions in Brittany and Normandy. They're amazing. I mean, a lot of them are King Arthur, the Arthurian sort of legends. Some of them have unicorns in them. Some of them are a little bit scatological, a little bit funny. And they're all about courtly love, right? And courtly love is this alternate kind of narrative that took shape in the courts of primarily France, primarily Eleanor of Aquitaine's courts and her daughter's courts. And courtly love has very interesting rules that went against a lot of the rules of the church at the time. For instance, distance doesn't matter in courtly love. Marriage doesn't matter. Like either party could be married and wouldn't matter in courtly love. So it's this parallel narrative to the narrative of the Catholic Church that I found just fascinating, right? Because what we're told about the Middle Ages really, I guess, makes the Middle Ages seem devoid of humor, like very single-minded, very serious, sacred, cold, right? But obviously, people of the time were just as complicated as we are now, and just as interesting, and just wild, and free-thinking, and so. Yeah.
So at some point you came across Marie de France's work.
Yes.
And you let it germinate and all of that sort of thing. And then just how did it come together as a novel? How did you start thinking of it in those terms?
So yes, I took two semesters of Ancien Français and that's when I met Marie. And then I graduated and frequently over the past 20 years, I tried to do a translation of the Lay, sort of a prose translation, because I don't know if they need to be in poetry, but failed abjectly. It was not great. And then two things happened. I was up at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies, which is this amazing thing at Harvard, where they bring in artists, writers, academics of different disciplines, say astrophysicists and historians, so that their ideas get spread and seated, and you are encountered with uncomfortable ideas and people's work that you probably never would have encountered in any other way, and it's thrilling. So the night before the moment when I actually had my vision, I was coming back from some event in Arizona, and I was on the plane. And I turned on the classic movie station and saw this movie. It was called The Women. Do you know it?
I don't know.
So good. It's from 1939, I believe. It's a Cukor. George Cukor. He wrote Philadelphia Story. So right. It's like snappy dialogue. Anita Loos actually did the screenplay, right? And she wrote Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, one of my favorite novels. Period. It's so funny. Right. So it's so good. It's so good. And the only characters are women. And it's amazing, but it's like I watched it feeling both incredibly lifted by this, but also really sad because even though all the characters are women, the only thing they talk about are men.
Right? Yeah, it was a George Cukor.
It was a George Cukor. Right? So I was thinking about this film when I went to my friend's lecture. Her name is Dr. Katie Bugis. She's at Notre Dame. And she studies the liturgy of medieval nuns, especially from this time. And it's not that I wanted to be a medievalist. I was kind of interested, but I didn't think it was going to change my life. And I sat down and I started listening. And Katie is such a passionate educator, and she loves these women, like palpably loves them, that as I was sitting, all of these elements, Louis de France and the movie I'd just seen and what she was saying came together, and I saw the matrix. I saw the book I had to write, and so I put aside the book that I was writing and just sort of focused on this for the next 9 months.
Set the scene for people who have not read this yet.
Sure.
Of that period of Eleanor of Aquitaine, the court, and how much of Marie de France did you have to then sort of, obviously the inner workings of all of these characters you had to do. But on the surface, was some of what Marie did it follow her life in some way?
Well, we do not know almost anything about her.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah, we only, well, she was only a writer. She was the first female published poet in the French language that we know of. Mm-hmm. And she has had strong followers throughout the ages. I mean, she's really a groundbreaker. But we didn't know anything about her because she, at the time, the only women we knew anything about were either saints or, the relational to powerful men. So the mothers of kings, the wives of kings, the daughters of kings. And Marie, we don't know. So there are suppositions, right? Of course, people think that she could have been an abbess who came across from France into England. She could have been an illegitimate noble. Some people say she could have been Marie, the daughter of Eleanor of Aquitaine from her first marriage. So it was really tricky because, of course, I didn't really have a whole lot except for the work that she wrote and that came out of her mind. So what I did is I went back to those works and pulled out these vivid images and these ideas and built basically a matrix for a biography that I then just supposed was her biography. And that's how I did it.
And you did it so
thank you.
It's so realistic and so it's like I'm reading a piece of history as I
knock on wood.
With the inner life being brought to the surface.
You know who I was thinking of? Penelope Fitzgerald, who's one of the greats, especially when writing about historical times. Her The Blue Flower is about Novalis. Yeah. And the way that she's very light about it, she's very suggestive about things that are happening, but she never hits you over the head. She was my model.
Some of the contemporary people who did that were people like Michael Ondaatje. Those fictional autobiographies.
Oh, my goodness.
Those fictional biographies.
Coming Through Slaughter. It's a book that I've read probably 10 times.
The one on Billy the Kid.
Yes,
even his own memoir,
good.
Running in the Family.
Also
which
great.
Is also sort of that very way.
Yes.
What is truth when you're talking about someone else?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So you then had to do a lot of research.
It was actually the most exciting part of this whole very exciting process was I I wrote to an abbess of an extant abbey in Connecticut called Regina Laudis, and she very kindly allowed me to come and stay in the guest house, and you get to eat the food that the nuns produce. These are Benedictine nuns who are in full enclosure, and the most beautiful humans you've ever talked to in your entire life. I talked to probably five of them in depth over the course of my stay, only a few days, and cried every single time because they were just so giving and loving and wonderful. And you got to work with them too, because work is prayer, according to the Benedictine rule. And it was just spectacular. And I was allowed to go to a couple of masses and to hear the singing. And I didn't know what I was seeking when I went there, but something about the palpable love, the way that the nuns interacted and were open, really changed the course of the book. So yeah.
Well, what you did with Marie, and I'm really curious as to where it came from, if she was patterned after anyone else, but you gave her such agency.
Well, a little patterned after me. She has all my flaws.
She was really appealing in so many ways.
Well, but also a megalomaniac in a lot of ways.
Very true. Well, but she was driven.
She was very ambitious.
Because she was driven out of a sense, I guess, you know, out of this relationship she had with Eleanor, that she felt wronged by Eleanor.
Yes.
Am I right about that? And wanted to sort of prove that she could do something.
Wronged. And, you know, she had internalized these courtly love narratives. And so the distant, untouchable love was something that she idealized. And so Eleanor became that for her, too. It's very complicated, this relationship, because Eleanor did not want anything to do with Marie when she was just the 17-year-old gawky, rude creature that she was trying to get rid of. And then suddenly Marie was proving herself and was able to make this abbey turn around. And the nuns weren't starving. And then at the time, abbeys that were powerful and had a lot of land were actually baroness of the throne. And so the abbess was a baroness, basically, of the throne. And so that meant that she had to provide men for war. She had to provide a huge amount of taxes to go into the coffers. And so she gained power in the external world as well.
And then... I imagine many of the women went on crusades, it seems like.
Well, so this is apocryphal. Eleanor of Aquitain definitely went on the crusades, and she had some of her ladies too. There's apparently Turkish historians wrote about seeing these Western women riding down the hills on these horses with their hair sort of flowing in the wind and the crusader uniform, which is white silk with a red cross, it was swords brandished and everything. And that was such a vivid image that I had to put it in my book. And so out of that sort of mention in, I believe, Turkish historians' work, there came this myth of the ladies' army that may or may not be true. Nobody quite knows. But we do know for a fact that a lot of women did go to accompany their husbands.
Well, I guess what was interesting to me, and maybe why I got confused by thinking of her as a spiritual being in that sense, is that through her sense of agency, she tried to empower the other women who are also in the abbey, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she even took on, you know, she would be viewed, it was sacrilege where she took on, she took on giving sermons and conducting mass and listening to confession, right?
Yeah, a lot of
things. Or is that what actually happened?
So not all in the same abbey, but there are instances in the historical record of, I mean, any nun can take confession from any other nun. This has always been the thing that people do. Any kind of clergy member can do that. And it happens a lot. And of course, you have a confessor who's your confessor. So it's not common. But there have been instances of abbesses taking for themselves the power of giving the mass. And of course, that was squelched very, very quickly because it was predominantly a male prerogative. All of the things that Marie does, I tried to base on the historical record, even if not, I mean, there was no figure like her as sort of a virago like her who's just right out to just to wreck the church and make it her own.
Well, it's also heartbreaking at the end too. I don't want to have a spoiler alert. I guess the visions that she had, or she viewed as visions.
Yeah, yeah.
There were so many interesting, intricate things that we could just go down rabbit holes and start talking about. I mean, the whole idea of sexuality in the in the Abbey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that you basically, at one point, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember correctly, you say that she's talking about, you know, the love of other women, and she's saying that there was no law against or no rule against what she called, which is really interesting, female sodomy.
Which was really interesting. Yeah, well, because who was making the rules at the time? All men, especially clerical men who were ostensibly not ever looking at or touching women, so they didn't have any understanding of female physiology.
Right.
And therefore, I think people believe that if a male weren't involved, there could be
sex. I think you said that. You said that, and somewhere I heard you talking, you said that, you know, men of that period thought it was impossible.
It's impossible. Doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
I know. And he's like, well, I'll show you.
No, it was really quite astonishing. And also, we're layering our reading of that from a 21st century perspective.
Yes, right.
Going through the Puritan period.
Right.
Going through everything else
that we've
gone through. So the naturalness of it was so interesting. And what you also did, and maybe this gets into practice, but what you also did is through language, through syntax, through everything that a good writer does. I mean, I felt like I was in that period.
Oh, good.
You had me going to my dictionary more than at any time I think I've ever read it. No, but it was fascinating. There were all of these words. How do you find those words?
There were all of these
amazing words that, you know, even the words dealing with hawks, dealing with food, dealing with nature, things that I wasn't quite aware of.
Oh, you know, I take so much joy in writing. And I, you know, I have so much pleasure in the texture of the phrase and the right word in the right place. And that comes, you know, I began as a poet, a very bad poet, as with everything so far, other than fiction that I've tried. And that's the part of it that I just delight in. That gives me, if coming up against a word like in falconry, a hawk that is caught in the wild and then taken in order to be trained to be sort of a sporting hawk, that's called a haggard, right?
Right.
And that's the most amazing word because we use it a lot. We say, oh, she's looking haggard, which means like a wild caught hawk, right? There's this element of captivity, of unhappiness in the word that I love so much.
Well, that brings me to Matrix, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So I started going down that road and trying, and I found all these interesting definitions of Matrix.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what it is for you.
Because there's
like 37 meanings of the word matrix.
At least. It's one of my favorite words, which is why I fought very, very hard to have this book be titled Matrix, even with Keanu Reeves coming out with a new
book. Right. Well, we don't call it The Matrix.
Matrix. Some people do, and I get a little irritated. I had to fight for it because it is the word that sort of reflects back into the book in about a dozen different ways. So matrix comes from Latin for mother. And it is a word that is used in so many disciplines, right? In geology, it is the bedrock in which gems are found. There's a matrix as an organizational structure, not just computer structure, which is, I think, what the matrix is. There is a matrix that is, it's sort of the seal matrix is how you close a letter in medieval times with the wax and you press the seal matrix into it.
Which makes an appearance,
so does in the book Eve as matrix, as the mother of all.
Well, the definition of matrix that I was keeping in mind when I was looking through was womb.
Yeah, womb. Absolutely. Womb is,
I mean, and there's nothing more. I mean, womb, mother, that all makes
womb,
sense.
Womb, mother. Yes, exactly.
But the idea of the womb was something really very, very poignant for me.
The place out of which other things come, right? I mean, and that sort of reflects into the meaning that I find actually closest to the book itself, which is the original on which other things are made. So the original record from which other records are pressed, or the original form on which sculptures are then created afterward.
Right.
So that's the meaning that gave me chills when I saw it and I knew it. Yeah.
And the question for the reader is, does Marie de France become a matrix in some
that
way?
That is the question.
For what happens later on, and we know
I can't tell you.
I'm not asking you. I read it, but and I don't want to tell anybody because we ruin what happens.
Yeah.
But you write so movingly of nature and ecology, and that has such a presence in this book all over. And in the last few pages, you talk about that, and so which leads me to really believe that you were thinking in some part of that mind of yours, because I know how interested you are in what's happening in our world today. You know, in terms of what Matrix tells us about our world today. And if you could talk about that a little bit, that would be great.
Yes, absolutely. I am not supposed to say this, but I'm going to anyway. Sorry, Claire. This is one of a loose triptych of three books that are all talking about God, climate change, women in nature, the way that humanity has misread Genesis, has domination and not dominion, which is more nurturing and more lovely. And so part of my vision for this book, which is the first of the three, would be I wanted... You know, historical fiction is this interesting chimera, because the modern reader picks it up and knows that it's written recently. And so there's always that question, because we know that we're not actually in the 12th century or the 13th century. We're coming from a contemporary angle. So some people, like Henry James, think that is... what gives historical fiction its artificiality, and therefore it can never be like true literature. Other people like me like to play with it, because now we can look at the past as the roots of where we are now, right? We can look at the past as sort of the prototype or the early place for the next 1,000 years. It's where we end up with the Anthropocene and sort of the cusp of climate apocalypse, where we are absolutely right now. So I think that my vision for this book was to see, could there have been an alternate way, right? Could there have been just resistance to the path we ended up taking? And I don't know, because I do think Marie did internalize a lot of the hierarchy. Yeah. She internalized a lot of the proto-capitalism in the feudalist system, right? And that created preeminence of the human over nature.
Does the writer have a responsibility when it comes to morality in our world?
Oh, that's a really fascinating question, and one I cannot address in the next hour and a half. But I do think, you know, I think the writer has to have a profound moral responsibility to their work and to their reader. Does that mean that the writer writes polemical work?
Right. That's
no.
Different.
That right. Well, but I actually think a lot of people are conflating that.
They feel like
they
have
at the moment, in particular.
Right.
And I think that is a really severe issue, particularly with American literature, that this need to be polemical.
Right.
I do think it's a moral, not rigidity, but it's a moral depth and a moral insatiability that I think the writer or any artist needs to draw on in order to create something that is actually posing questions, shaking the foundations of what it is that the reader and the artist itself, themselves think they know about the world. That's my definition of what art is, right? I think there are beautiful books in the world that don't do this, and possibly, maybe I'm being a jerk, but I wouldn't say that they're art. I think confirmation of the biases that we come into a book with, that that's entertainment. And there are plenty of books we go to for entertainment, but I wouldn't call that art. In fact, I would hope that a book shakes you. A book makes you see the world differently.
And then how about the writer outside of his or her work? Mm.
See, that's a different
writer as activist.
Yeah,
in a sense.
I think. See, I find that a different thing, and I think that a lot of people would resist what I'm saying, which is absolutely fine for them. I don't think of art as utilitarian, but I think that people who are given a voice and a loud voice in the world, who have this moral, like, fixity, I think that they, I believe that I need to step forward and say things and do things. And sometimes I'm going to make horrible mistakes. But I think that it's important to be engaged in not just the work, but also the world. Absolutely necessary to be engaged in the world and try to make things better. But that's just being a citizen, to be perfectly honest. I mean, some people just don't have the energy, and that's fine too. My personal choice is to try to do both.
We all had a lot of hope back in January. How are you feeling now? I mean, what happened in Texas is just horrific.
It's horrific. But it's a strange time, right? Because there's still light on the horizon. It's just it's frustrating. I mean, I've been on the board of the Florida Planned Parenthood, the large Florida Planned Parenthood affiliate, since 2011. And so we've seen Texas coming, and it's coming for Florida too, just FYI, and it's horrific. The amount of suffering that's going to occur to particularly women or people with uteruses and the children that they're, I mean, the suffering of the children is going to be so horrible. So I'm kind of devastated, to be honest, to see this coming. I mean, we saw it coming when the Republicans wouldn't let Obama nominate a Supreme Court justice. Like, everyone knew what was happening. And there were things we could have done, and we didn't do them. So now we're in for another decade or two decades of retrograde laws. We're going to lose a lot of ground in a lot of different ways, I think.
And so your voice is so much appreciated.
Oh, thanks.
When I hear it.
I make mistakes, but I think that the general desire to make the world better. I mean, that's what, unfortunately, like, I don't know this until I actually go out on tour and people tell me what my book is about. But that is one of those things that every one of my books is sort of testing and trying to experiment with and trying to figure out, like, how can we be better? How can we create better communities that actually care about the vulnerable and the weak? And often in my books, it fails because it has failed in life too, but this is something that's really, really important if we're going to survive as, like,
so where does this
humans.
Come where does this come from? What were your parents like? What are they like?
Oh, they're great. So my parents are very Calvinist. My dad's a doctor. My mom put him through med school and was a biology teacher, and then at 53 went back to school to become a physician assistant, which is hard to do even if you're young, and then, you know.
Right.
So they're really hardworking. They're really morally morally rigid, but also very passionate about the world. And I think they gave all of us this feeling of rage.
Would you read a little something?
Oh, sure.
Could you do that?
Oh, sure.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin your binding. She rides out of the forest alone, 17 years old in the cold March drizzle, Marie, who comes from France. It is 11:58, and the world bears the weariness of late Lent. Soon it will be Easter, which arrives early this year. In the fields, the seeds uncurl in the dark, cold soil, ready to punch into the freer air. She sees for the first time the abbey, pale and aloof on a rise in this damp valley, the clouds drawn up from the ocean and wrung against the hills in constant rainfall. Most of the year, this place is emerald and sapphire, bursting under dampness, thick with sheep and chaffinches and newts, delicate mushrooms poking from the rich soil. But now, in late winter, all is gray and full of shadows.
Thank you, Lauren, for being on The Literary Life. Matrix is your new book, and it's remarkable.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.